Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Well, let's close the wall up with our English day.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we say our names together so well.
Yes, we have trained our entire lives to say our own names.
And the telephone number is in here if you would like to call and ask us or discuss something that has to do with the economy or investing or things of that ilk. 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And what else is going on? There's a little background thing. He wanted us to talk about Greece. Do we want to get Greece?
Let's do Greece.
Okay, I want to talk about Ukraine.
But that's not Greece.
Which we'll get to after Greece. I just want to let you know that there's some stuff going on there that's pretty critical. But anyway, but first, is your dog psychic?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Oh, okay, just
it's checking. Possible.
It's almost possible.
Right? I have not.
So we're going to talk about Greece. Do you want to talk about Greece?
Sure.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Back when the big bailout program happened, and this is another one of those things where I laugh at the term bailout.
The big bailout business.
Right. The bailout, basically.
The big bailout business, basically.
Yeah. The Troika.
Before.
Yes. We're using lots of B words. Alliteration is important.
Yes.
Greece agreed to pay back a whole bunch of debt, obviously.
But less debt than they owed.
Right. So they owed a lot of debt, and the European Union said, well, we're going to forgive some of that. We're going to give you an interest rate that's kind of stiff, but you need to pay back the debt that we are not forgiving. This part you have to pay back.
Right.
And here are the conditions on us forgiving the part of the debt that we are forgiving. One, you've got to do austerity. You've got to stop all this spending stuff. You've got to balance your budget. And since then, their gross domestic product has dropped by a third, close to 30% drop. Because they're not creating things because of austerity. So the amount of debt as a percentage of their GDP has actually grown. Even though their actual debt as a real number has come down because they've been making payments. As a percentage of what they own, it's now bigger than it has ever been. And the Greeks, for some reason, are not really happy with this.
Yeah, there's about roughly 40% of the people in Greece do not have a job.
Right. And another big chunk of them...
40% of the people who would like to be working do not have a job.
Correct. Another big chunk of them, the people that are working, don't pay taxes. And it's kind of an accepted thing of, hey, we're not going to pay taxes because we don't have to. Why not? Well, because we're going to lie on our returns. And that is such a pervasive thing there, that the idea that you don't have to pay taxes if you've got a good enough accountant to figure out some way of making it look like you are paying taxes.
You mean to say sort of like we have in the United States?
Absolutely not, actually. These surveys that go out every year say, and it's the same questions are asked in the Greek world as they are here in the United States. Will you cheat on your taxes if you could get away with it? And 90% of the people in the United States say no. In Greece, 90% say yes. If you can get away with it, if you've got a good reason that you think you can get away with it, they're going to cheat. On top of that, when people are asked, if you know of a friend who's cheating on their taxes, what is it that you feel? In Greece, they feel jubilant. They feel happy for the person that's cheating on the taxes. In the United States, people feel disgruntled. They feel upset that someone that they know is not paying their taxes.
So,
and if you can ask a Republican or a Democrat, you get the same numbers. We look at it as our duty, which is why we don't like the taxes to go up, because it's our duty to pay them.
So you're trying to say, if I can rephrase this, that in the United States, if we know somebody who isn't paying their taxes, they're cheating on their taxes, we are disgruntled.
Yes. Otherwise, we are gruntled.
But in Greece, when they hear about somebody who's not paying their fair taxes, they're cheating on their taxes, they're gruntled.
Yes. The gruntled Greeks love to not pay taxes.
Well, I mean, it's the difference between being gruntled and disgruntled. Greeks are gruntled. Americans are disgruntled.
Seems pretty easy to me. Yeah.
The thing about Greece that is significant here is that they have threatened to start vetoing everything the European Union wants to do. For example, the European Union, and this is why I wanted to bring up Ukraine, this is kind of buried in the back pages and so on.
Negotiations going on
here. The negotiations, there aren't any negotiations.
Greece negotiations, where they're saying this is what's going on.
But the reason I want to bring up Ukraine in relation to Greece is there was a commission set up to monitor the ceasefire, and there was a Russian general, and there's a NATO general, and so on, and a Ukrainian general. Well, the place where they set up to monitor the ceasefire is near the ceasefire line.
Right.
And the Russians and all their staff pulled out one day, and the next day the Ukrainians attacked the Ukrainians.
The Russians
who are pretending to be Ukrainians, who speak Russian and have Russian passports. And
they look like little green men.
Yes. And anyway, they started an attack the next day. So it's pretty clear the Russians knew it was coming. And this is the point I want to make. The war has kicked up again. The peace process in Ukraine has died. The Ukrainian supposed head of the Free State of Ukraine, or whatever it's called, which is basically he speaks Russian when he makes his pronouncements, by the way,
right,
is really proud of the fact that they have started the offensive again, and he's saying this on the radio, while the Russians are simultaneously saying that no offensive activity is going on among the rebels. It is strictly NATO attacking the rebels. NATO, okay?
Yeah.
Now, the reason I want to say all this, let me tie this down.
I've got some other good stuff to throw in there, too.
The new prime minister in Greece has said, if you want to raise sanctions on Russia because of this new attack, he will veto them. He warned the European Union. The European Union is put together in such a way that any one member can block all action.
Correct.
And he's That's already
why
said,
they still don't have a constitution, right, because Ireland vetoed it, and then, you know,
then France did.
Then France did separately. So a second time it came in. Okay, nope, we don't like that. Everybody else agreed. But all it takes is one country at this point to stop the whole union.
This is Greece basically is in this position, blackmailing Europe with the support of Russia, and the new Greek prime minister traveled to Russia and met in Moscow with Prime Minister Putin, and they said they wanted to establish better ties. It's pretty complex over there, and we're basically getting ready to fight World War I is what it looks like.
Let me throw in another little piece of information here. A lot of money that came for the support in this election by the people that won the election came from former Russian citizens that are now living in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
So the pieces all look like something to me. The puzzle pieces come together and look like Putin is supporting the new Greek government so that he doesn't get more sanctions when they take over Ukraine.
And we were talking about religion earlier. And this ties into religion because the Greek Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church consider themselves to be, and I quote, sister churches.
Yeah.
The Roman Church and the Protestants are considered to be their enemies, and this dates back to
way,
the medieval period.
Yeah, way czars were in charge.
And believe it or not, both sides are still angry about the Crusades.
Yeah. And who got Constantinople versus Istanbul and so on.
And so what we have is a very complex situation going on over there. We look at it as very simply, the Greeks owe money, they don't want to pay it back. The Germans, who, by the way, the Greeks don't particularly care for because of an event that occurred in the 1940s that many of us don't remember anymore.
What happened in the 1940s?
There was this little expansion of Germany into Greece.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And they executed a lot of people in Greece for no particular reason.
Yeah.
But the
it's
point
only 70 years ago.
The point is they remember like it was only 70 years ago.
Right.
Had we been invaded and conquered by Germany 70 years ago, we might still remember it too.
Yeah.
But the point is that the Germans are telling the Greeks, very much I guess what the conservatives in Congress are telling the country, what you need to do is just cut your spending into a depression and keep cutting your spending And they are in the awkward position now of having a collapsing, deflating economy in Greece. And frankly, the austerity solution has proven itself not to work, but the Germans insist that you keep working it.
Right. And this is important to me. There is no established, respected school of economic thought that thinks that in a recession you should do austerity. Zero. Not one.
Well, I think there's one in Germany somewhere.
Well, it's not an economic thought. It's a political thought.
Yes.
I mean, when you're talking about Milton Friedman, who is supposed to be laissez-faire, which is let the economy do what it wants, even he said that in times of recession, governments should spend more. And if you go, I mean, you just go down any real thought-out school of economic thought, and you recognize that if things are going poorly, you don't spend less as a government. You might as a company, but not as a government. In governments, you take some more debt, you pay, and you try to create an environment where new businesses can prosper. And that takes money. You can't just create that environment without spending.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you just a little bit here. I agree with your philosophy.
Uh-huh.
I agree with Milton Friedman.
Uh-huh.
But you forgot the Austrians.
Oh, yeah. Well,
the Austrian economic school. And remember that Austria, Österreich.
Yeah. You're right.
Is German. They speak German. They think German. And the Germans think like the Austrians, and the Austrians think like the Germans. Been there, done that. You can't tell the difference.
The thing is that there aren't that many people that still follow that school. It's been destroyed.
There's actually a lot of people in Germany who follow that school, and a lot of people in Austria who follow that school.
More as a religion. Yeah.
And they believe in austerity and tighten your belt. And the whole thought, by
it
the way.
It doesn't work,
if you actually read the documents from the Austrian school, what they would expect is that Greece will utterly collapse. And
correct.
They will
a
totally
new government
collapse.
Will come up out of that.
Not just a new government, but a new economy.
Right.
And a lot of people will starve to death, and that's okay.
There's a problem with that in that the integrations that have happened in Greece, they're now part of the European Union. The government cannot collapse.
I disagree.
I'm not saying an imperative, it cannot, it's not possible. I'm saying it cannot, or European Union will have some serious issues. So by pushing this austerity and causing the collapse of a government in Greece, what is very easily the result of that is further collapses of governments in Spain and Portugal and so on. If they stick to the line that they're following in Germany, they are going to pull all of Europe into a depression.
I have said a long time ago, several years ago, that's a long time.
Yeah, a very long time.
I don't think the Eurozone can sustain itself over a long period of time.
Not without a constitution, not without a really well-regulated central bank that isn't politically organized with a different head every year.
Just as in the United States, it took an invasion and a socioeconomic collapse for us to go from the Articles of Confederation, where we had a dollar, we had a monetary union, but no central government.
Correct.
Each state could veto. Each state would go its own way. To a constitution. Now, why did we decide we needed a constitution? Fundamentally, because Britain wanted to take us back, A, and B, we had a massive socioeconomic collapse. When I was a kid, we still had a saying that I think has probably gone out of style now.
Not worth a continental dollar.
Not worth a continental. And it really boiled down to the fact that the continental dollar, which was the currency of the United States before the Constitution, collapsed to nothing. It became valueless. Very similar to the way the German currency did in the 1930s.
It was literally used to paper walls, to put up a wallpaper and help with the insulation of houses.
And Europe, unfortunately, the Eurozone is going in the same direction. And I think Russia is providing the invading force. But I really do think there will have to be a collapse there before they're capable of fixing it. and I'm not sure they're able to fix it at that point. At least in the United States, we all spoke the same language. And when you look at the number of languages that are spoken in Europe, let's put it like this. It's not going to be a totally pretty outcome, whatever comes out of Europe, which is one of the reasons, by the way, that the dollar is rising against the euro, is because very gradually other entities around the world are looking at the eurozone and concluding that whatever it is they have there may not be able to survive. And it's not coincidental, by the way, that in the United States, the Comptroller of the Currency, the FDIC, and the Federal Reserve do stress tests. They do them together on major financial institutions in the United States, what they call systemically significant financial institutions. In other words, one, the too big to fail guys. And they do these stress tests on them. And the last stress test they did was the euro totally collapses. What are you going to do about it? Show me what you would do in your bank and what would happen to your bank, your insurance company. There's only a couple of insurance companies that are regulated this way. Your investment bank, whatever it is you have, if the euro totally collapses and goes worthless. And so that's our stress test. And we had a number of banks pass it, and we had some that failed it. We had only one, Bank of New York, that made a profit in the stress test scenario. The Europeans, on the other hand, when they do their stress test, their entire stress test is, what would happen if Greece defaults to your bank? Now, I want you to think about that just a second. In Europe, if they were to run the same stress test, they would say, what would happen if the euro collapses? And all the banks and most of the, if not all of the major insurance companies in Europe would become insolvent. You want to get something to be a little bit scared about, that's it. And, of course, the issue is if Greece can get away by simply saying, we're not paying our debts back, there's a lot of banks and insurance companies in Europe who still hold Greek debt that suddenly will lose the money.
Right.
That isn't fatal. What is fatal is if Portugal and Spain and Italy, who also owe a lot of money and are suffering through some degree of austerity so that they can pay back debts to the Germans, mainly, if they were to say, if Greece can get away with it, so can we, and not pay their debts back, that would be a really serious collapse.
It's the equivalent of a run on the bank.
Yeah.
It's the loss of confidence in anybody else's word. And if you think about what it is that these big debt instruments are called, they're called a 30-year bond. And if you have heard the statement, my word is my bond, or someone is bonded, that has a deep meaning in the confidence world of, if you agreed to do this, then you should do it. And if a government can turn around and turn its back on that, what's going on with Greece, it may be that Greece will be pulled out of the European Union. But even that is something that, if they do that, if they pull Greece completely out of the Union, then they are not following the successful model that they started trying to follow, and that's the United States. The United States, you mentioned this very clearly with the Articles of Confederation and the continental dollar collapse and so on. We created a constitution. It was ratified by all the states. We had Bill of Rights added to it. We have amendments that keep going with it. The federal government was given a certain amount of power, but we still fought a major war over whether or not the federal government had preemptive rights over the states. We fought a war that is the largest death toll of American citizens in the history of our country over whether or not the federal government had the control of the states to, and we still argue about it. If the Greeks leave the Union, the European Union, then there is nothing binding the Union together. There's nothing holding it.
There's really nothing holding it now, but their imagination.
Right, their imagination.
And the Greeks will, in essence, have made the statement the emperor has no clothes.
Right. If they leave, then Spain will leave, and Portugal will leave, and Italy will leave.
Well, we don't know that, but this distinct, they could.
Right. They'll have the ability to. Right now, everybody's pretending like the ability doesn't exist. Okay, we cannot leave because we've all agreed to do this. As soon as one entity does, they all can. And if you think about how far the Union has come, we don't want instability in that part of the world. We really don't want instability in that part of the world. And the closer we can knit those countries, the better it is for everybody, because that's the place in the world that causes world wars. That's the place that in the history of our world has caused the biggest wars, because they have little issues that they don't solve peacefully there, and then we have to send our people over there to get killed.
Yeah, there's a fascinating scenario that I just came from a conference where I spoke and was discussing. There's some very strategic thinkers there. And one of the things I discussed that they hadn't really thought about, if you're into being reasonably intellectual and reading things, there's a book called The Panic of 1907 that's an example of what I'm talking about. The Panic of 1907, if you're really familiar with what happened in 2008, and you read The Panic of 1907, you'll think you're reading the same story with just different names in it and different
deja vu
technologies.
All over again.
And if that near 100-year cycle is repeating itself, which it tends to do in history, then this would be 1914. And in 1914, in the Balkans, in that area where Greece and Ukraine are, there were things starting to pop up and anger starting to be shown and armies starting to maneuver and one country slightly invading other countries. This instability in that region of the world is what ultimately generated World War One. And the issue was that the diplomacy and the communications were operating at different speeds. And we can even draw that into Poland. And this is a fascinating thing. You know, the United States signed a treaty with Ukraine several years ago, like 10, 15 years ago. If they would give up all their nuclear weapons, we would guarantee their borders.
Right. The Russians signed the same treaty.
Right. And the Russians violated it as soon as they grabbed Crimea. This is the point.
Yeah, let me lay that real quick.
But we haven't done anything about it.
Right. We signed a treaty with them that we would protect and enforce their borders. The Russians signed a treaty with them that they would protect and enforce their borders if they gave up their nuclear arsenal. And people say, well, what's the big deal there? Nuclear arsenal of Ukraine was the third largest in the world at that point. And now it is zero. They have zero nuclear weapons. They had the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world.
Now, admittedly, they couldn't do anything with it because they were Russian nuclear weapons.
The
Russians
had
just left behind, and they were deteriorating. And the reason
they could have done something
right,
with them,
the
they
issue,
could have taken
right,
them
have
apart
sold them.
And sold them, or they could have used them on their own. They do have heavy in industry.
Right.
They had enough resources to put together.
Yeah, but they also had a dictator that was a jerk.
Yeah, that's true.
But the whole point at that point, we and the Russians and everybody else wanted to get those nuclear weapons someplace where the terrorists couldn't get to them because they were A, deteriorating, and B, not well secured. But the point is, we in the United States, as well as the Germans, as well as the French, as well as the British, signed a treaty with Ukraine guaranteeing the sovereignty of their borders when Russia moved in blatantly
and took Crimea
and took part of Ukraine and has now moved in
doing it again
and is doing it again despite the fact they're denying it.
This
is the point. We're not
back with that.
It's very much like Poland at the beginning of World War II. Everybody may have raised a stink. Well, not just Poland, but Czechoslovakia and a whole series of other places, when the Germans moved in, we didn't do anything. We said, let's offer diplomacy and let's put up economic sanctions. By the way, we did the same thing with Japan. We slapped economic sanctions
which
on them.
Which they considered an act of war.
And the Russians, by the way, have stated over and over again that our economic sanctions, if we take them one step further, which we've discussed doing, which is cutting off all bank transfers, basically isolating Russia from the bank transfer protocol, the Russian finance minister said that will be an act of war.
Right. Let me hit 2 points here. Mariupol is the place where the fighting is going on in Ukraine right now. It started the day after the Russians pulled out of the peace talks. They just didn't show up one day. And then the next day, a massive rocket attack hit a major civilian area in Mariupol, which hasn't had much in the way of fighting up to this point. Mariupol is down on the south coast of Ukraine. And if you draw a line along the coast from Russia down to Crimea, they need a road. Right now they've got a ferry that they have to cross. There's a contract that's just been issued to one of Putin's cronies, who is one of the people that was targeted in sanctions, for roughly $2 billion to put a major bridge across to Ukraine. $2 billion is a lot of money to the Russians right now, a very large amount of money to the Russians right now. If they can accomplish a road to Crimea through the southern part of Ukraine, it's going to cost a lot less than $2 billion. And that's what they're doing. So just as a side note, this major rocket attack hits. The rebels say, we didn't do it. Nobody did it. It was probably NATO. NATO did it. I realize they would have been attacking their allies, but NATO's, that's what they do. And then the offensive begins same day, and the rebel leader said, yes, we are invading Mariupol, and yes, we did the rockets with the thing that I said we didn't do. Yes, we did that, and it was part of our initial attack. And then 10 minutes later, same speech, said, we didn't have anything to do with a rocket attack. This is intentional. There are books written by high-level Russian generals that are being used right now. And unfortunately, I don't speak Russian. But there is a word in Russian that has the word mask in it. And it is the style of warfare that is being trained in the Russian army, which is confuse as much as possible. If you recall, do you remember the convoy of Russian aid trucks, the white painted trucks that were sick? They were supposed to cross at a rebel controlled crossing point, and they never actually crossed. But the Western media was so attracted to these 100 trucks all sitting in a parking lot, basically 10 miles away from the border, that they weren't watching all the other border cross points where the Russians were just sweeping huge amounts of artillery and tanks and stuff into Ukraine while everybody's looking over at the white-painted trucks. This is an example of genius. If you think about the D-Day, the Allies confused the Germans by doing a whole bunch of radio transmissions around North Africa, and they put in a bunch of rubber tanks, inflated rubber tanks, so that when people looked at them, it looked like there was a mass of military stuff being built up while the actual invasion was going on at Normandy, to prepare for invasion in Normandy. This is what the Russians are doing. They're looking at this the same way we looked at World War II. How do we invade? How do we take? And that's what they're doing. And as much as they can confuse, they've at this point recognized they're not going to get any support from the West, period. So, but the West is not going to stop them once they've taken it. Nobody's stepped in and said, we're going to invade Crimea and take it back from the Russians. We really don't. We have the ability, but it would be incredibly expensive for us to do that. So the Russians are saying, all right, the only thing that they get upset about is us being unsuccessful. So let's just be successful. That's what's going on there. And that's a problem. And the fact that they are, utilizing Greece as a tool on the board to
and
hit
the things that we're talking about right here, by the way, why the market is down on about 4% so far this year. Not because of U.S. earnings. Apple came in with record earnings. The iPhone is selling much faster than people appreciated. There's a lot of things positive going on in the U.S. economy. People are afraid of what might happen in Europe and with Russia. Now, economically, in the long term, if you're a long-term investor, is any of this stuff dangerous to you? No. If you are a short-term investor,
boy,
which most investors unfortunately are, if you're going to bail out because you're afraid, this is going to be really scary stuff. And the reason we're bringing this up is not because we want you to be afraid, but critically, if all of this bad stuff happens that I just described, it will leave the United States of America in the absolutely dominant position on the planet, far more so than we are today. And it will leave us in the position where there's an awful lot of stuff in Europe that has to be replaced that we will replace. That's crass of me. It's crude. But the point that I'm trying to make is there could be some really bad things if history repeats itself, and it looks like it's in the process of doing that. There could be some really bumpy things occur related to what's going on in Europe. But if you are a long-term investor and you're properly positioned as we go into something like this, you don't have a lot to worry about. Now, speaking of things to worry about,
we have commercials to play.
We have commercials, and Lord knows I worry about commercials. So this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we're going to break for commercials. So if you'd like to give us a call on the other side or near the other side of the commercials, you're certainly welcome to do so. It's 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And that's all dependent on if it's January 31st, 2015, where you are. If it's some other date, don't bother calling because we won't be able to hear you. And we'll be back on the other side of these commercials, these important words from Town Square's sponsors.
Are you one of the millions?
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure. And we have a caller that has been patiently waiting on 773-1400. So caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I find your show very fascinating, and I have a couple of questions.
All right.
I'd like to ask, and then I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
You talked about what could possibly happen in Europe. How does the Muslim population in Europe play into this? And also, since everything's kind of connected, how does China?
You need to turn down your radio a little bit too.
And how does China play into all this?
Okay, good questions.
All good questions.
Thanks for calling. Muslim population in Europe, most of them are Europeans.
Yeah.
The vast majority are Europeans. They behave, they've gotten relatively upset in several places. There's a small minority of people in the Muslim population in Great Britain and in France and in other places who are radicalized, but there's also a small population of Germans who are neo-Nazis.
Right. So. If you look at, just as a side note, because it's really easy to start painting with a broad brush. The Oklahoma Federal Building bombing was not done by Islamic terrorists.
However, that's initially who they were looking for.
Right, and keep in mind that there are wackos in any religion.
Just north of here, there's a whole town named after them.
Right, and yeah, exactly. But there are distinct sects of Islam that are radicalized, that have stated that they want to kill Americans, kill Europeans, so on and so forth. There are distinct sets of Christians that have said similar things, and Buddhists that have said similar things, and so on.
I don't know if the Buddhists have, but the Hindus have.
Oh, the Buddhists definitely have.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There's a in Western Asia, there's a whole angry militant Buddhist monks that want to kill a lot of people.
Yes, it's absurd as the rest of it is.
Right. The reality is that most religions are, the ones that are popular today anyway, are religions of peace. The Norse pantheon was definitely not a religion of peace. It was basically you don't get to Valhalla unless you get there by killing people.
Right. Well, then there are some sects within Islam today that have that same philosophy.
And within Christianity.
Right.
And, I mean, basically, there are songs that people sing in churches all across the United States about being a Christian soldier. I'm not saying that's bad. Please don't hear that wrong.
Well, it's good to remember that there's recent movies out about the fact that the soldiers did not want to kill each other at Christmas
right.
in World War One, and
right.
many officers who participated in that were punished severely, and the Christian churches of both sides were saying your duty before Christ is to kill either
Christians.
The Germans or the British
right.
or the French or somebody.
So just keep that in mind when talking about that there's
religion,
a knee-jerk reaction to go Islamophobic. There are real threats in sects of Islam, and as soon as we say that the threats are everywhere, we can't focus on the real ones.
Mm-hmm.
The real ones exist, and they're not all Muslims. They are very few Muslims. They're not all Christians. There are very few Christians. They're not all, and so on. You know where I'm going with that. So
mm-hmm.
keeping that in mind,
and
on to the rest of the
question.
Yes,
about China. The Chinese are interested in holding their country empire together and in providing stability at all costs, and are not at all interested in expanding into anything, and they support the dollar wholeheartedly, and
yeah.
they have probably done a pretty good job of recognizing that the euro is not going to last, so
yeah.
they're just going to try to keep holding themselves together.
I see China right now as a stabilizing force
yeah.
on the economy.
And we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I've got a question about ETFs.
Okay.
Is there a downside to owning an ETF? And the reason I ask the question is, if they're such a good deal, how come they weren't around 50 years ago?
There's a downside, there's an upside.
Yeah. There's what you want to talk about first.
Down.
Okay.
Good
well,
question.
From the downside point of view, if you actually study what an ETF is and how it works, it's very complex, and it requires some institution out there to basically make a market in the ETF independently. We've had ETFs that have blown up.
All right, let me.
And that's the point, is that an ETF really isn't as stable as it looks. It's held together sort of artificially. It's an artificial entity. It's a derivative. On the other hand, a mutual fund is protected under the Investment Company Act of 1940. And is extremely stable. That's your big negative.
Okay, so let me lay in some groundwork here, because we just kind of jumped right into a complex area. Mutual funds have existed for centuries.
Oh, yeah,
they were,
but not as they're known today.
Right. They were regulated in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
Basically what they were is a bunch of people, kind of an investment club, would get together, pool their money, and buy stuff with it.
Right.
And
the economic technical term, stuff.
Stuff.
Right.
You buy stuff. And then at the end of the day, you say, all right, what portion do I own of that, and what's it
mm-hmm.
worth?
Right.
In 1940, they regulated that, because there were people that were saying, you own 50% of the pool, and you own 50% of the pool, and you own 50% of the pool, and you get 150%. That's a problem. So mutual funds were regulated, and were regulated under the Investment Company Act of 1940. ETFs, a lot of times, will use mutual funds. However, mutual funds are traded at the end of the day. So that same concept of how do I know how much I own, if I own a percentage of a pool of investments, we've got to add up each of those individual investments inside it to see how much each part is, and then get a correct. It's called a net asset value. And the net asset value is set at the end of the day when you've got a good idea of what everything is. An ETF doesn't trade at net asset value. It's not the mutual fund's value. When you buy a unit of a mutual fund, I'm talking open-ended mutual funds at this point. You buy
a
share. One share equals a percentage of the actual assets owned by the mutual fund. An ETF is traded throughout the day. And when you buy the ETF, it is going to be close most of the time to the net asset value when you buy the share. Except, however, right. when it's not, it can be really, really different. You can actually spend a lot more money to get a lot less stuff, or a lot less money to get a lot more stuff.
Since 1940, since the registration of the mutual fund, by the way, the mutual fund, under the if it's registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940, which almost all of them are, if any of the entities associated with it become insolvent, the shares of the mutual fund are unaffected. They still belong to the shareholder, you.
Yeah, those net assets belong to the investors.
Most ETFs, not all, but most ETFs are not registered under the Act.
Correct.
And they are supported by some commercial institution or entity. If that commercial institution or entity either cheats or goes bankrupt, just wave goodbye to your money. Now, we've had several instances recently where the SEC has gone in and hammered ETF originating companies for fraud. And the ETF, of course, promptly, and sometimes they're actively managed ETFs. In some cases, they were theoretically following some index. But, of course, the value of the ETF suddenly collapses, and the underlying index doesn't collapse. So an ETF carries what I would call a significant, what we refer to as non-systemic risk. And a non-systemic risk is you invest in the stock market, that's the system. You invest in Enron,
That's not the system anymore.
You've assumed a great deal of non-systemic risk. You invest in Exxon. As solid as Exxon is, it's possible that tomorrow on Monday morning there's a headline, Exxon accounting fraud.
Whatever. It could be anything.
Company declares bankruptcy.
Dump truck hits CEO. It doesn't matter what it is. It's going to be any number of things can be the.
And ETFs are subject to all of those fraudulent issues. And what the heck are you doing trying to trade mutual funds in the middle of the day anyway?
This is the one other piece. Mutual funds, generally, the vast, vast majority of them have a limitation on buying and selling, number of times you can buy and sell, because what a mutual fund is designed to be is a long-term investment where you're investing in the concept of the management of the fund. If a manager says, I'm going to track the S&P 500, or I'm going to buy only this type of company, you're actually investing in a discipline. And when you give money to that manager and then immediately take it away, they may have just bought something with that money, which means they have to sell something with the money, which means you are negatively impacting the other investors in the mutual fund, which is why there's limitations on it. With an ETF, it's not actually a mutual fund. Even when they are registered, you're buying a derivative, basically a thing that says I'm trying to track the mutual fund, which is why you can get more or less when you buy an ETF.
Trying to track the index.
Right. If it's an index, and there's other cases where it's actually just a completely non-index mutual fund.
And there's some ETFs that are, I would say, certainly relatively safe. And there's some ETFs that are just scary as all get out. And very frankly, they could both be attempting to do the same thing and both claim to be doing the same thing, and one of them is so unstable, you just sure better keep an eye on it all the time, and the other one you can dump your money into and pretty much forget about. They are very, very, very complex securities.
And they really don't have a rule set that is clearly defined.
And
I think that's one of the things that Congress should do right now is put together a small bill saying, here are the guidelines. Here are the rules that you have to follow if you have an ETF.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't exist. The SEC has stuff, but they change it regularly.
And the SEC's rules and the regulations, the laws that they're operating under were never designed to create an ETF. The ETFs are artificial things that have been created, and the SEC has just kind of gradually said, well, that's okay, and, well, yeah, you can do this too.
We're going to have a period of open discourse about this, and then we may put a regulation in on that.
The issue is that, frankly, we kind of steer away from ETFs, and in many cases, as the ETFs have been evolving, this is what's fascinating to me. You can go find a mutual fund, if you do a little bit of research, in some cases you can find a mutual fund that has lower expenses than the ETFs now.
Right.
So ETFs are very sophisticated.
It's just a question of how fast you want to be trading.
And what the heck are you doing wanting to be trading fast in a mutual fund anyway? You're speculating. You're not investing.
Okay.
Okay, you answered my question.
Okay.
One more quick one.
All right.
Back when I was a young fella, back in the early 50s, if you were a millionaire, you were rich.
Mm-hmm.
How much money you need today to be considered rich?
Good question.
I'll hang up and listen.
We just have a few seconds left. I think the definition of rich is having more money than you know what to do with. So
got
if
it.
You know somebody that has more money than you know what to do with, your definition of them is rich.
I would say
they
that,
are probably
right.
not considering themselves rich, though.
If you are a millionaire, you're wealthy.
So, we don't have a lot of time. If you'd like to contact us off the air, you can reach voicemail locally at
947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, listen to podcasts, see our faces, all that stuff. Till next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.
The following is a